and welcome to episode 199 of the Awesome Comics Podcast, the place where the small press makes one hell of a big noise. I'm Vince Hunt, creator of The Red Mask from Mars, and I'm here with the creator of the webcomic Vanguard, Dan Butcher.
Hello.
And our very own Bilbo Baggins of Bag End. It's Tony Esmond.
All right, Frodo.
Yeah. We've all got
hairy... Can I say why I call you Frodo?
Go on.
Because similar to Frodo, you've also had your ring destroyed.
And I just want to make it clear to all of our listeners, that joke had absolutely no reference this week. He's just being mean. That's the sort of Tony Esmond you get when we're almost to episode 200.
Yeah, the 200.
Big 200, where it all goes wrong. Yeah.
Where it all goes wrong. Where it all goes badly, badly wrong. But we'll talk a bit more about that in a bit, because it's another exciting week this week with this week's guest. Yes, and another big name to add to the list of people that are probably never going to talk to us again once they talk to us.
They do sort of block us once we speak
Yeah. We're only kidding, of course. It's always fun talking to these men. Don't make me laugh.
He's gone full Partridge.
Do you know what, Dan? I think Tony's had a few espressos this week.
A few sherbets.
Yeah. Or maybe he's had both. Can you imagine that much sugar and caffeine pumping through his system?
Alcohol. Never. I'm like a fucking, what are those stupid toy things? Gizmo, whatever it's called. Don't give me alcohol after midday.
Oh, the gremlin.
You talking about Mogwais? Oh, do you know what? I knew you reminded me of something. Anyway, do you know what these guys also remind me of? Good comics. And do you know where you can get some absolutely fantastic comics?
That is a tenuous link, but yeah, let's do it.
That made me grip my arms.
We just want to say thank you to our sponsors, Comic House, for sticking with us. Yes, of course, as always, this show is brought to you by Comic House, who are the indie comic marketplace that we love. And there's a huge selection of titles on their website, because not only do they have a database full of fantastic small press comics, but if you self-publish your comic, you can also put yours on there for free and start selling your books that you've slaved God knows how long on creating. And and they only take a tiny, tiny, tiny commission of each sale. So it's another way, it's another avenue for selling your book. But what we talk about all the time, as everyone knows, because normally people take the mick out of me for saying it's the Netflix for comics, but that's because it is. And yes, Comic House have a fantastic app that's got tons of digital comics on
there. And our guests on it.
Yes, and our guest has some books on there as well, yes. Now, what else have they got on there at the moment, Dan?
This week we've got Gallant and Amos Collected Adventures 1, Legendary Tailspinners 2, Purgatory Issue 4, Destiny Aura 1 and 2, The Enlightenment Gun Volume 3, and To Kill Volume 1.
Oh, yes. I'm in Gallant and Amos. I wrote the intro.
Oh, nice one.
Yeah.
You get about, don't you, Tony?
I do. Dan, I was on another podcast today talking about another book that's on Comic House. I was on the Mega City Books podcast, the 2000 AD sort of related collected edition podcast with Eamon, who's a good lad. Nice. And I talked about Rock of the Reds, which is almost also on there, which is a great read.
Oh, that's great.
Amazing.
That episode is
going to be out in a couple of weeks, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, there was one that you'd like come out today, Vince, actually, which is The 13th Floor, I think it's called, isn't it?
Oh, nice. Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, that's a really good one. And I read some of them today as well, and that's a good comic.
That's also got a collection, like that Turbo Jones collection that I talked about.
Yeah, same company.
A few weeks ago, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, nice. Oh, well, that's something else to listen to this week. I always like discovering new podcasts. And new books.
Yeah, podcasts, actually.
Which is why Comic House is a great app for it. And, thank you to them for sponsoring us every week. For the actual app itself, it's like Netflix and stuff like that. And for only £3 a month, you get access to the enormous library of digital indie comics. And there's some amazing stuff on there. Well worth putting your comics on there if you publish them. As comic publishers ourselves, we will say that that's a great avenue for doing it.
Yeah, if it's finance, it's just going to come from somewhere else that you didn't expect.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. You know,
and especially if you've got these books that you've got a PDF of, you've got no printed copies anymore, and you know, if the old book's just sitting there gathering dust, put it on there. People are going to read it. And people are going to enjoy it.
And don't worry about them having books on multiple platforms. I think the days are gone now where we worry about having things on more than one platform.
Yeah,
I think if you put it on Comixology, you may as well put it on there as well.
Yeah, yeah. We're kind of at a strange time when you can, like, we've got so many streaming services now, and it just seems best for comics, at least, is to have them on them all, because there's nothing lost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
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 So it's a fantastic way to sort of publish your comics and get them out to a wider audience. And also, if you just love reading comics, then go to comichouse.com, find out about the 14-day free trial and get involved and see why we talk about so many of these great books that we see on there. There you go. Anyway, we're not going to mess about this week. It's another one of those cracking weeks where, you know, we're very pleased to be talking to the guest, which just turned up out of the blue. It's another one to be checked off the list. We did Evan Dorkin, and we're still getting nice feedback from that.
Yeah, we are, aren't we?
Yeah.
But this week, we were hugely pleased to talk to Phil Hester, who's written some of my favourite books of all time. And he's a fantastic artist in his own right as well. So this was a fantastic chat. So without further ado, here you go for your listening pleasure. Okay, folks, it's another exciting week for us here on the ACP. It always feels weird when they call us the ACP, but I guess that's where we are now. This week we're joined by a writer and artist whose career has not only involved collaborations with the likes of Warren Ellis, Kevin Smith, Mike Huddleston and Alex Ross, to name but a few, but he's also responsible for such fantastic titles like Deep Sleeper, The Coffin and The Wretch, and many other titles that no doubt you've read. It's our pleasure to welcome Phil Hester to the show. Hello, sir.
Hey guys, how are you?
Hey Phil, good man.
Phil.
Yeah, good to
have
you on.
Yeah.
We're good. We're pretty chilled out. We haven't had a comic convention this weekend, but I know you have, haven't we?
I have. Yeah, it was just a little mini con, but it's fun. You know, you have to support the local scene and kind of get out there and convert people to the cause of comics. It was an independent comics expo. You know, there are a million of those that are like whatever.
Yeah,
you know, town it's in / okay. ice, and and this was sort of the Iowa ice.
Yeah,
and
it
was just, you know, mostly small press people, but you know, it's a good chance to be sort of a goodwill ambassador for comics, and that's sort of my.
Do you have any local?
That's the role I'm okay with.
Yeah. Do you have any local comics professionals who you sort of you buddied up with at all, or you run
ideas? Oh yeah. Well, like I told you guys before the show. In the Midwest, local is like anything within a 5 to 6 hour drive.
Right.
So, okay. Yeah, like I feel like I'm collaborating with my neighbor right now on a book I do called Stronghold at Aftershock.
Yes.
I do with a brilliant artist named Ryan Kelly. And I consider him local, but he's like 4.5 hours north of me. He's in Minneapolis.
What's that Douglas Adams quote? And you think it's a long way to the chemist. That's the
it's a long, you know, but that's, you know, I drive up to that show on a regular basis too, and it's you know, there's all sorts of people here in the mid, you know, Kansas City is sort of the hub of Midwestern comic scene, and maybe even more so than Chicago. A lot of really great talented writers and artists live in Kansas City.
Okay, because I saw Mike Norton a couple of weeks ago. He did Edinburgh.
He's Mr. Chicago, him and Seeley and those guys.
Yeah, and you've worked with Seeley, haven't you? You did the Godzilla book. I know we'll get into it in a bit, but
I did the Seeley with Eric Powell of The Goon.
Oh, of course you did. Pardon me, sorry.
But I am working with Tim Seeley on something we haven't announced yet. So
Yeah. Ooh.
No, I mean, we haven't got a title, so it's not an exclusive, but that's the first I heard about it. So yeah. It's an exclusive to me.
It's just a little thing, but it's very fun, and it's sort of I get to like check off the childhood dream box on this one. So,
Right, when we finish this conversation, we might have to throw you some more questions once we're finished. So to get us started, I mean, just a glance at your Twitter feed, like anyone can see that you live and breathe comics, which is amazing. That's always the person we want to talk to on this show.
Yeah.
But for you, where did you first discover your love of comics, and what was it that sort of drove you to sort of make them?
Well, like everybody, you know, when I was a kid, and I moved around a lot when I was a kid to follow my father's work. And then when I was sort of right at, you know, when I was prepubescent, 12, 13, my parents split up and we had to move back to a really small town. And so when so much of my life was kind of unpredictable to me, it was sort of my, I don't want to say duty, but it was like a sort of an ocean of stability to build this other world for myself that was this sort of fantasy world. And like the atlas of that fantasy world was these two and more universes, you know, at Marvel and DC, and also, you know, fantasy books and science fiction, things like that.
Yeah.
And being that sort of second stable world was sort of a lifeline for me. And so that, as a kid, I just, and of course, I don't want, that sounds too like, you know, serious. They were just cool. You know, I really like comics.
Yeah. I mean, I think for a lot of us of a certain age, comics were also our babysitters, weren't they, really?
Yeah.
And our parents went to the shops and just left us alone. You know, please don't stick things in the oven, or, you know, put in a
electric socket.
The electric socket. Yeah. You know, they gave us a Hulk comic to read. You know, there's a bit of that going on, wasn't there? You know.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, since I got my own money, I would, you know, ride my bike to the local drugstore or the grocery store, wherever. Back when comics were in those places.
And
you know, spend my lawn mowing money on stuff like that. So I started building a collection when I was probably 10 or 11, and then got really serious about it when I was 13. And I don't know, I was reading, I've told this story a million times, so some people get bored.
That's all right.
It's so fast, you know, use your little fast forward feature on this part. But I was reading an Iron Man comic that ended on a cliffhanger when I was a kid. And back then you were not assured of getting the next issue in any way.
Yeah, we were very like that over here. It was very patchy distribution in the
UK. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was like, I'm not going to wait to find out what the end of this comic is. I'm just going to write and draw my own end of this comic.
Cool.
And I, folded up a couple pieces of typing paper and wrote and drew my own ending. And then it struck me, all those names at the front of the comic book are people that are doing this. And the credits, those are all people that are doing what I'm doing right now, except for really well. And so I thought maybe I'll just be one of those people when I grew up.
Okay. Simple as that.
How did your comic come next to the Iron Man one? Did you ever get it, the next issue?
It was pretty close, honestly. It was pretty close. Which, I mean, except for mine was totally inept, but it was pretty close.
Yeah. Anyway,
So all the way through high school, I just kept making more and more comics with my friends, and you know, it was like, I was like insufferable about it. We like would have schedules, and like I pretended we had deadlines that we had to meet, and I was just, and I had different books, different titles in the line. Like we have to have a humor comic. We have to have a horror comic, you know, just on and on. But it was sort of like perfect training for doing this as I got older.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun, and I still look back on those really fondly. And it was also a way for me to sort of, I moved to a small town where everybody had been in the same classes together since like kindergarten. And so I was like the first real outsider to join the school in like years, and sort of like doing these comics, a lot of them that were lampooning our teachers even. Was a good way to sort of like make myself known to those other students and sort of become part of the population. So
okay, so when you first noticed these names that were on the comics, who were creators that stuck out for you at the time?
Well, when you're 10, at least when you're 10 and in 1976, like the easiest person to recognize is Jack Kirby.
Because
his style was so, you know, Baroque, especially at that time. It was just really...
So he was back at Marvel at that point, wasn't he? You were doing Captain America and...
He came back to do Dinosaur and She-Man, things like that. And that was just easy for me to, you know, for one thing, to identify. But also, he's like, he tapped into that sort of like, whatever eternal flame lays in the imagination of 10-year-old boys, and he kept it alive in himself his whole life, and just his ideas like really resonated with me. Like, Oh yeah, like riding a red dinosaur would be great. Like, I need to know more about this, you know.
I can see you drawing a Devil Dinosaur book, dude. I can your style would certainly, yeah.
I would love it. But you know, all the guys, all the artists that were sort of hot around then were sort of clicked or connected with me, and I feel like I was lucky that I was also, I guess, I don't want to credit myself with being broad-minded, but I was also into like more grotesque and sort of underground kind of artists that were working at that time too. So like my hippie uncles had Swamp Things and Fantagores laying around, so you know I could see Bernie Wrightsons and Richard Corbins at a young
Oh,
age,
wow. Okay. Yeah, it's
and
cool. Yeah.
yeah, I sort of got dragged in that direction too. So you know, I don't want
Because I've
to.
heard you mentioned that you're something of a mashup between Joe State and Bernie
Yeah,
Wrightson, you know.
right,
Yeah.
exactly. Like it's you tr you have these ideas that you're like, oh, I'm going to mold myself into being a certain kind of artist,
Yeah.
but it's really like the whatever you saw when you were 10 that like flipped a switch in you. And those two books were E-Man, the first go round of E-Man at Charlton with
Oh, I
Joe
loved
State.
E-Man. We didn't really get Charlton over here in the UK because
Right.
I'm of a similar age to you, Phil. But we got the first comic stuff, which was good as well. You know.
Yeah, but it was a little more cynical and
Yeah, it
not
was a
as
little bit more pop culture almost, wasn't it?
right. Yeah,
Yeah.
it became sort of a parody book.
Yeah, it
But
did. Yeah. Yeah.
the first time around, it was almost it, well, not almost. It was naive. I mean, it
Right.
was, but very breezy and beautiful cartooning, and that really spoke to me. And
Yeah.
at the same time, I saw DC was reprinting Swamp Thing in those dollar size digests that they
Oh
did
yeah,
over in the
I know.
States,
Yeah.
and those I like stole from my uncles or they gave them to me, I can't remember. But those two things are sort of like the poles of my early influences, you know.
Yeah.
And that's why my work is such a mess, because I'm trying to reconcile that brightness of Joe Staton, that brightness and bounciness and liveliness with the sort of intricate murkiness of Bernie Wrightson. And so
Yeah.
I think that's like, no matter how bright of a thing I draw, there's always going to be like an ugliness in the core of it somewhere.
Okay.
And then
Yeah.
no matter how dark a thing I'm going to draw, it's always going to have like a little leavening cartooniness to it. And that's intractable. I can't, believe me, I've been tracting for a long time. I can't separate those things out of my style.
Wow, that's
But
interesting. I don't know why people don't talk more about. Sorry to interrupt. I don't know why people don't talk more about Joe Staton. He was doing event books at DC back in the 80s and stuff. Yeah,
yeah,
and
he's
he's
doing
still on the
Millennium.
circuit. Yeah,
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
he's a delightful guy, and people should make an effort to talk to him and
Yeah.
give him the due he deserves, because
His
he
Dick
was like
Tracy
the
stuff's
stalwart.
great. And yeah.
Oh yeah, and he's Green Lantern to me,
Yeah.
you know,
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
like
Completely.
Lantern
Yeah.
forever.
Yeah, he
I
was on
think a
it for a
lot of
long time.
people as well, they definitely need to pay dues to, I mean, I haven't been to so many of these huge conventions, but when I've been to a couple, and you see these classic creators, and they're just sort of sitting there, and no one
Yeah. Right.
really bothers them,
Yeah. Is that standing
Yeah,
on the shoulders of giants thing?
Right.
It kind of came home to me. I was at a convention once, and I saw like a bigger line for to take pictures with somebody who had a really cool Iron Man cosplay than there was for
Yeah.
Gene Colan, you
Oh,
know.
yeah, I know. I had it before, obviously before the Infinity Avengers movies and stuff like that. I went to, I think the first New York actually, walked around, and then Jim Starlin was sitting there on his own, and I took him an Avengers annual to sign. He said, "This is the first thing I've signed all day." And I'm like, "Oh my God, this is Jim Starlin. He's amazing." Yeah.
Well, thankfully that has changed.
Yeah, thankfully. Yeah, definitely.
I
Yeah.
saw him in Kansas City the other day, and last year I was lucky to illustrate a short story of his.
Oh wow,
And
okay.
I was going to say, you know, I don't do this, but Jim Starlin's a big, big, big influence and a big hero of mine.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to have him sign this. And I'm like, I can't. This is like, I can't be away from my table for 2 hours.
Right, okay.
And
Yeah.
also, And also, I'm not going to cross the Rubicon and bring him a book in the bar. I am not going to do that. I'm not going to be that guy.
Yeah. If you're ever at the same convention, anything signing, just give it to me. I'll get it done for you, Phil.
Okay, yeah. Dirty work.
What's the sort of convention scene like for you, like at the moment?
I probably do a dozen a year, and they range from very, very small shows like I did yesterday.
Yeah.
To like, I don't tend to do their super mega conventions anymore because I don't really, they're kind of wearying. You know, like San Diego and Emerald City are just have become these, they're just so massive.
Yeah.
And, or New York's the same way. They're just so massive, they don't really feel.
Yeah, unless you know where the bar's going to be and everyone goes to the same bar and has a drink. I think sometimes they're just a business opportunity, yeah. Aren't they, you know?
And also, yeah. plus when artists go there, I know we know some artists who have been like bigger conventions and they'll have the full day and then they got to go back to their hotel and they're still working. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And a busy convention is tiring at the best of times. Good, so yeah. to then go back to your hotel, it really wipes
you out.
Yeah.
And my favorite kind of conventions are sort of throwbacks where all the guests are in the same hotel. Like even events are in the same hotel. And so you sort of hang out together and get to know people. And it's like I did a convention in Dallas last year and it was a smaller show. But I was in the same hotel as Carl Potts and I got to talk to Carl Potts and hear, cool. you know, stories of what, you know, Marvel and DC were like in the 70s and what it was like to work in Neil Adams' studio at that time, which is all that, what it's like to talk to Steve Ditko and all that stuff's like gold. That's gold to me.
Yeah. We have a tradition over here because up until the last sort of 7 or 8 years, our conventions were fairly small and mainly dominated by 2000 AD because it was kind of our only thing for a while.
Right.
And those guys can drink, I tell you now. That's that's like starting to drink at midday. And that they just turned into like everyone from the convention hall would walk into the bar and it would continue. It was like one of those sort of things.
Right.
Yeah. But now we've got things called MCM over here, which are they owned by the same company that own New York, I think, aren't they, guys? Is that right now?
I'm not too sure about that.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Reed Pop?
Yeah, I think they own it. I think someone like that. Yeah, and it's very similar sort of thing. You know, pop culture, movies, cosplay, computer games, models.
That's all fine. Xboxes, that's all wonderful. That's all wonderful. But
as long as people buy your comics. Yeah.
Right. But I'm there to, you know, meet my heroes or get advice about my work or, you know, and for me, that's better done when you can have like one-on-one conversations with the artists and writers. And that's better accomplished, I think, at smaller shows.
Yeah,
I agree. Completely.
I think something you said there is something that stands out to me, like about you and your work as well. Because when we announce we have Phil Hester on the show. Obviously, you've had a sort of storied career. You know, you worked on some fantastic titles. But there you said, advice on my work. You're always looking to learn and improve, aren't you?
Yeah, because, listen, I don't hold my work in super high regard. So it's kind of
we'll do that for you, don't worry.
Yeah.
You can bear that burden. But I know a lot of people who are sort of like the same artist they were when they were 23 or 26.
Yeah, we've talked about a few of them recently.
Right, and they were beautiful. Listen, they were beautiful artists then, but they're treading water. So I have this philosophy that like you can never crash if you never peak. So I'm gonna be this. This like unmoving wave, like my whole career, this flat line from beginning to end. No, I feel like there's always something to learn, and no matter how good you get at what you're doing, if you're doing it right, you're just discovering new vistas on the horizon, you know, and it's a never ending thing. And if you feel like you've conquered it and you're never going to get any better, guess what, you're right. You aren't going to get any better. That's it.
Yeah, the next project has to be the best project, doesn't it? The next one is like, right.
Yeah.
No matter how much you love a project.
Your last bit work, aren't you? Really, let's face it.
Yeah. Anytime anybody asks me what my favorite thing I've ever drawn is, I'm like, it's always the thing in front of me. It's always.
Right, good. Yeah.
The job I'm working on.
Yeah. And it should be, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that how you feel when it comes to writing as well? Because you're like a double-edged sword with the art and the writing.
Right. I'm maybe just now, because I was like a babe in the woods for so long, that I would write something that I thought was good and think, I've done it, and like sort of lean back and go back to drawing.
Yeah.
And I'm now learning enough about drawing, about writing, to be as embarrassed about my writing as I am about my drawing. So I guess that's more progress too. But yeah,
But what struck me about you as well, Phyllis, is it's rare that you do both at once. Is that what I'm saying that?
Yeah, no, you're correct. I think part of that is because I just became of use to the comic book industry as an artist first, and got known that way and hired that way first. But I was always writing and drawing my own stories, like my whole life. And even when I was drawing Swamp Thing, I was writing and drawing stories for anthologies like Negative Burn or Taboo. And I was feeling like those, and I was an idiot, because like I always felt like those were little diversions.
Okay.
While I was doing my real work, which was drawing like Captain America Annual or whatever. And actually those little diversions hold up better now, you know 20 and 30 years later. Those little short stories and little kind of odds and ends I were doing feel better to me than the mainstream work I was doing at the time.
Oh,
but now when I do a project, I try to cast myself realistically. So if I come up with a project and I'm not the right artist for it, I'm not going to draw it.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
Of all the things I've written and not drawn, I think probably the only one I felt like I was right to draw and didn't was I think I did at Boom a while ago called The Anchor.
Okay.
That I did with Brian Chirilla.
Yeah.
And I there's no way I would have done it better than Brian, but drawing an aged, like hulking supernatural bruiser is like in my wheelhouse.
Has there ever been a time where an editor has come to you and said, we'd like you to write and draw this, and you've gone, no, I think I'm the right choice for the artist, or I'm the right choice for the writer, but I'm not the right choice to do both? Has that happened? Or
yeah, it happened on Hellboy, and it killed the job, and afterwards I was like, oh, I probably should not have done that. Scott Alley asked me to write and draw a Hellboy thing.
Right.
And I was like, I'll write one for Huddleston to draw.
Yeah.
And this was back when Huddleston was not a household name.
He's become a beast of his own, hasn't he, Huddleston?
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's an artist.
Yeah.
And he wasn't a big name yet. And they were like, no, we really want you to draw. And I was like, this idea is better for Mike. And then they stopped calling back. So, yeah. But usually when I talk about casting myself, it's on like a creator-owned project that I'm calling the shots on.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, Mike's one of those artists as well. Just the evolution of his work. Obviously, I discovered him when it came to The Coffin. And then, but to see what he does now. And I mean, the jump from The Coffin to Deep Sleeper was...
Right.
You know, it looks like a different artist has done it. And to see what he did with... Is it Butcher Baker? Which to recommend on the show.
Right, I think.
He's just... And he's really sort of... He's constantly pushing it as well, isn't he? I mean, what's that thing like for you to see, like, his evolution, you know?
I sort of knew he was that kind of artist when I met him. I met him when he was 13. And he was, like, terrifyingly good then. And,
right.
Like, he was working for DC, like, in his very early 20s. He and Mahfood, Jim Mahfood, are sort of, like, they were, like, a dynamic duo back then.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I like them both, actually. You can see you can see their work in each other, can't you? Almost, yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah. And I met them when they were little tots. And but when I think back on it, I was almost a tot too. Like, I was like in my early, I was in my like early 20s when I met him. But I could just tell he was like never going to be satisfied with whatever he had done. And he wanted to always like find new things to work on and new ways to express himself. And he has lived up to that. I mean, he's had plenty of opportunities to sort of like, cash in and just maintain one style and sort of milk it. And he's never been happy with that. He's always, like veered left when anyone's asked him to settle down and just go do his own thing. And it's really admirable. And also, by the way, the results are always stunning. So he's always made the right move.
Yeah. And his evolution, I mean, for me, to go from like the coffin to Deep Sleeper, for instance, we see artists that we love now that sometimes when you see their early work, you think, hang on, this just looks like Jim Lee, or this just looks like Joe McGuire or something like that.
Yeah.
And then they become their own style. Whereas Huddleston's work, I never saw anything like it. And then what he went on to, I never saw anything like it. He evolved into his own thing, didn't he? Which is amazing.
Right. Yeah. He had a trap he stayed out of, and then, I don't know if this is too inside baseball, but he had such a gratifying grasp of realism that could have been a very seductive trap for him to fall into that and just sort of refine and, you know, sort of go on that John Bolton path of like just super refining that realism until it became kind of stultifying.
Yeah.
And he fought that. He was like, no, I'm going to Deep Sleeper. I'm going to like put my Paul Pope boots on and blow.
Kind of went the other way, didn't he? Yeah. Almost. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, just like I was talking about, like the things I can't shed about my style, he cannot shed that core ability to like render things realistically. So when he does something that, it's like Sienkiewicz has this too.
Right.
Even if he did something that is completely just like pushing the boundaries of like between representational and abstract art, at its core, everything's still drawn right.
You know? Yeah.
And Mike's got that too. So like, even if he's weird, even if he does something.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Incredibly strange. Everything.
Frank, you know, Miles, he knows what he's doing. Yeah.
A lot of people don't see this in Frank stuff, but I do. If you strip away the sort of itchy rendering that Frank does, that very kind of almost idiosyncratic mark making that he does, he's as accurate as Frank Frazetta. You know, his drawing is dead on. It's just that he approaches it in this sort of, like I said, this kind of idiosyncratic mark making that makes it look completely new and foreign and alien to a lot of people. But if you stare at it with unfocused eyes, you'll see that his drawing is all money. It's all dead on.
Cool. Mm. Yeah. Is there with your writer hat on, is there anyone else who you've written for that when you've got the pages back, they've captured what you've sort of imagined? And it's a weird one as a writer, isn't it? Sometimes it almost changes our opinion of a story when we get it back, but sometimes it comes back as how we imagined it. Is there anyone?
I think everybody's always improved what I've given them. And even when they've given me back something I didn't see, that's sort of the danger of writing as an artist, is that you haven't, at least I always do, have a mental image of how a scene is going to be staged or how a page is going to play out. And when it comes back, it's often different. And I would say almost every time it's better.
Yeah.
Okay.
How do you supply those scripts? Do you like, are you a writer that just gives them the scripts and just leaves them to it, or do you do little thumbnails if you've got a certain idea you're thinking of?
Yeah.
It depends. It's sort of a hybrid. At the beginning of my career, I always worked in that Harvey Kurtzman method of providing a thumbnail. That's the way Harvey Kurtzman wrote all the war books that he edited for EC. He would write a story and then, you know, turn a piece of typing paper horizontal and just thumbnail the whole story and hand it off to like the greatest artist who ever worked in comics, which is such a dream job, you know? Like,
yeah,
I'm going to rough this out and give it to Toth or Williamson or, you know,
yeah,
or Jack Dix or whoever. But that's how I worked at the beginning of my career. And I still do that in certain cases. If I had, like, I just did that on an issue of Stronghold.
Right.
I had a very specific storytelling device I wanted to get across, and it would be just too difficult to explain it to Ryan. So I just thumbnailed it and showed it to him and said, this is what I'm talking about when I talk about this kind of, we do a ridiculous kind of Alan Moore, J.H. Williams kind of panel play in the right. fourth issue of Stronghold.
Okay.
And it's just easier to draw it than explain it to somebody.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but in the same token, if I have a really good relationship with an artist, I'm willing to work Marvel style with him, you know, just give him, dialogue beats and what I expect to happen on a page and then adjust to what they give me back.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. So Stronghold is actually, it's your second book with Aftershock, isn't it? Is that
mm-hmm.
I read the first two issues this week, mate. Very good. Really enjoying it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to do. And it's an idea I've had for a long time that I've just been dying to get out. And having Ryan sort of bring it to life has been really fun to do. Yeah.
Some great designs in it, aren't there? Some great alien style. Yeah.
And Aftershock is certainly a company that has been on our radar for quite some time since they arrived. Mm-hmm. Their books have appeared in the recommendations and stuff. So how did that relationship come about? Because it was Shipwreck with Warren Ellis, wasn't it? That was the first book you did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've known Joe Pruitt, sort of the founder of Aftershock, and I've known him since our Caliber days together.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
And Caliber was sort of, if like the majority of your audience wasn't alive or buying comics then.
you'd be surprised, dude. You'd be surprised.
I know. Yeah. I feel like I'm 52, but I feel older than 52. But it was Caliber was sort of seen as Vertigo's farm system, you know, for talent. Like a lot of people that wound up working at Vertigo got their starts at Caliber. And Joe was there, and Joe just loves comics, and he loves not being part of the mainstream and giving the talent that he knows the opportunity to tell the stories that other publishers would shy away from. And so I think if you look at Aftershock, their publishing ethos is, here are the things that other publishers said no to, you know?
Like
either chicken or didn't think they were commercial enough or whatever. But we trust the talent, and we want the talent to do the books that they care about.
Yeah.
And if you're an artist, hearing that and then also knowing you're going to be able to make a living while you make that book it's like the sweetest music you can hear.
Yeah. And the lineup, you know, I mean, the motley crew of creators that they've got on it, but you know, you go from books like A Walk Through Hell to Animosity, you know, Dark Arc, you know, there's so many different sort of types of stories. I keep seeing them like every week on Comixology, just thinking, well, that sounds amazing. Oh, right.
Yeah,
and then see another one. I haven't got enough money to get all of these.
Right. Yeah. I think if they have a sort of a motif, it might be horror, you know. I think they're sort of like kind of, but you can't really pigeonhole anything they do. I mean, there's, you got Garth's War stories, and you've got you have books that are like they did do a straight up superhero book. They did Jimmy and Amanda's Super Zero.
Oh, Super Zero.
So they'll do like I said, and that's the way I buy books. I don't buy a genre, and I don't buy even a title. I buy a creator. So I don't buy Green Lantern, but I'm buying Green Lantern right now, you know, because Grant's doing it, you know?
Yeah.
So,
but does that work with some of like the smaller press and indie books? Because of the nature of our show, we're always looking for stuff. Sometimes it'll just be that synopsis that I think, oh, I want more of that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that can work too, and that's why we do them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why we write that ad copy.
Yeah.
But I think
and those
the
first
people
two
that
pages
are...
or three pages now in Comixology,
right.
isn't it? They're important these days, aren't they? You know.
Oh yes. Oh yeah. But I think also the people that buy indie books are already we're already sorting out a subset of discerning readers. So these are people like. They're not waiting in line to go to Endgame this weekend. They're at like the Independent Comics Festival buying mini comics.
Okay.
They're and so they are people that follow talent already.
Yeah.
They don't think they don't look at a walk through hell. At least I don't know. They don't look at a walk through hell and get past the name Garth Ennis before they decide to buy it.
Yeah.
I don't think. And yeah. So that's sort of Aftershock, and then a lot of these other younger, like exciting companies like Vault or TKO or Black
Ahoy
Mask.
As well, or another one. Yeah, and, yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. They're all like sort of like, here's what we're offering. We're not offering you a superhero universe. We're offering our curation. You know, like
okay.
we think these are important talent, especially like in the case of Vault or Black Mask. It's young voices that are going to be heard from for quite a while after this.
Yeah.
Black
but it's
Crown a matter
like as well. We
yeah, exactly. About,
yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's all a matter of, and it's sort of probably the way the industry is going anyway. Cause like, I mean, really what does a publisher offer except their point of view?
I hate to say it, and it's something we go back to occasionally, being stuck in England somewhere between America and Europe is there's a little bit of a European flavor to that, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know?
Oh
you're bringing
yeah,
out non-interconnected series, you know, with a certain sort of almost genre appeal in each one, you know.
Right, exactly. But what they do offer is, here's our stable, and here's we talk to them about what they're doing, and we've helped refine this notion, this concept, and that's what we offer. We
right.
can't really offer. We can't offer you, this giant superhero universe.
Yeah.
It's going to be commodified later by some.
But you know what? The pressure's off then, isn't it? I feel great pressure on me when I go and buy an Avengers comic that I'm not reading. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I do. I really do these days.
Yeah.
And to read something from Ahoy or from Aftershock or Black Crown, I'm feeling like, well, I can just read this. I can just read Jimmy's Bastards or, you know, something like that. And I don't need to be everywhere else reading everything else, you know?
Right. Yeah. And it's almost, to my mind, it's almost like, you've got Marvel and DC, and then you've got everybody else that are sort of comprising this other big three, you know, this other third in the big three. And it's, of course, led by Image, where people are allowed to do whatever they want. And a beautiful place to be. And I'm working on a book for them right now.
Oh,
but,
cool.
Oh, nice.
It's, you know, it's sort of like, That's the place where we just go let artists be artists and do what they're going to do. And not there's no top down strategies smothering them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Which isn't to say I don't like working at those two places. I love it and I love those paychecks.
Yeah. I was gonna say you've done everything. I mean some of my favorite stuff you've done, for example, Green Arrow was outstanding, dude.
Yeah.
You know
it was a blast.
Yeah.
And it was at a time when a lot of people don't remember this, but it was at a time when like my style was like a very big outlier for DC Comics.
Right.
And at the time I was doing Green Arrow and Doug Monkey was doing Justice League.
Okay.
And we were at a little convention together and we looked at each other and we were like, can you believe we're doing the one in two books at DC? I guess weirdos. Because DC does not want that. DC, you know, DC wanted like their. I'm not going to insult an artist by naming an artist, but they wanted like the middle of the road.
Yeah. The house style. I'm not
right representation house style.
Yeah.
And like I'm over here being all cartoony, and Doug's over here being all European.
Yeah.
And you know, we were doing their number one and two books, we're sort of living in the afterworld of that now. Like
okay, interesting.
All sorts of weirdos are drawing all sorts of comics, and it's beautiful. You know, it's a neat thing now. And
I think consistency as well for me. I was buying that off the shelf. I had it in my pull list at the comic shop, and it was the fact that you knew what you were getting every month as well. And it was a it was a great sort of exciting adventure soap opera of a book. And I knew every week it was going to be this really readable thing, you know.
Yeah, I think that's sort of that's what Kevin brought to it, was this sort of conversational tone that his films have too.
Yeah.
That was sort of missing from comics at that time. And it really was kind of a breath of fresh air.
You've kind of worked with Kevin Smith a couple of times. Did you take over from on Bionic Man as well, did you, I think?
Yeah, we did two books together at Dynamite. We did Green Hornet and Bionic Man.
Oh, of course, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And they were both like the same situation where he had written a screenplay for each property.
Yeah.
And I came on and adapted the screenplay of Green Hornet to turn it into a comic. And even thumbnailed it, like we were talking about earlier, and even thumbnailed it for the artist Jonathan Lau. And then after Kevin left, you know what? Kevin's a lot more involved with that than people think. People think I just adapted his screenplay.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's not true. We were like on the phone a lot talking about how that comic should go. And he always had a final, polish on the script. So Kevin really wrote that comic. I just helped him write that comic.
Right.
And same thing with Bionic. We did the same process with Bionic Man. And on both books, I sort of took over after he left for a while.
Okay. Yeah. Both great books. Yeah, I'm a kid of the 70s, so the $60 million Man, the Bionic Man, is definitely in my wheelhouse. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I like when I was a kid, like the $6 million Man was like, if you knew a friend who had the $6 million Man doll, you had a rich friend.
Oh really? Okay.
Like, I was over here with the busted ass G.I. Joe like atomic band, or like the fuzzy, like back when G.I. Joe had his fuzzy afro and beard, you know?
Yeah.
I used to have one of them.
Those were nice and cheap, but $6 million Man was like, oh snap, that kid is rich.
Well, I'm not claiming to be a rich kid by any stretch, I got to tell you, but I had the $6 million Man. Action Men. And I remember staring through the back of his head for ages because he had a telescope eye.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something right now.
Yeah.
I guarantee that if you smelled the smell of his back of his head, you would remember it instantly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he had this weird skin that you could pull up and little bits of his bionics would pop out, wouldn't they? Do you remember?
That little soft plastic smell. You would know that instantly.
Yeah.
Oh, I have so many questions for you, Tony.
Yeah. You know, when next time we meet,
how he got so rich.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll be smelling the back of Vince's head next time I see him.
Don't do that with majors, though. You get kicked out of the convention. Yeah.
That's the voice of experience talking from Phil. Oh, dear. But, I mean, that's great. I mean, you've got quite a list of characters that you've either written for or drawn. Are there any sort of, you know, bucket list characters that you one day...
Definitely.
I mean, what are some of the sort of major sort of ones that you haven't tackled yet?
I have the one I'd love to write the Fantastic Four.
Okay.
I think that just like the whole here's a dysfunctional family of explorers is just a really cool idea.
Yeah.
And you can go, and you just need a big imagination really to take that on. And the big ideas go a long way in that book, and it would be a lot of fun to do that. And then as an artist, I have a couple of doozies at DC. One of them being Ragman, which is like...
I love Ragman.
Ragman.
And he's such a... just a compelling design.
Yeah. I love the Pat Broderick stuff when Pat Broderick...
It's all great. But the Joe stuff is just... like dynamite.
Amazing, isn't it?
I saw that first issue cover when I was a kid, and I was like, oh, what is this, you know?
Yeah.
And then the other one is sort of a near miss that I'm just bitter about and I want to rectify, which is there was a time, I think in the Rachel Pollack era of Doom Patrol, that Ted McKeever was going to come on be the regular penciler.
Right.
And Lou Stathis was the editor. And Lou was like, look, Ted cannot do a monthly. So he can maybe do 8 issues a year. So we're looking for somebody to do like 4 to 6 issues a year.
Right.
And I was like, oh, yes. Oh, of course. You know, whatever it takes. Like, Robot Man's one of my favorite characters of all time. So,
right.
Yeah, to do Doom Patrol would be a big coup for me.
Oh,
awesome.
Yeah, I'm a big Doom Patrol fan. All the eras. I love all the eras of Doom Patrol. You get people who pick
up. I do too.
Yeah.
And you know what? I was reading like a Paul Kupperberg one the other day.
Yes.
A Kupperberg Larson one. And people always remember the Grant book being sort of like this rejuvenation of the book. And it was. There's no denying that. But people forget that book was weird as hell before that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, people forget that it came out. Did it come out like the week before the X-Men or something?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, actually, it was similar. It was weird from the jump. And it was weird in the 70s and it was weird in the 80s. And like, I don't think people remember that Paul Kupperberg created Dorothy Spinner, you know?
Right. Yeah.
I don't think they remember that. They just remember the Grant and the Richard Case stuff as being so incredible, and it is incredible. It's like groundbreaking, but that book's always been like a weird mutt, and that will earn my eternal love forever and ever.
I mean, you've definitely got a love for the sort of quirkier sort of side of like storytelling, and you know, certainly with your writing as well. You know, we've said the word dreamlike several times on this show, and I know Tony Esmond's always a fan of the dreamlike. But you know, like Coffin and Deep Sleeper, you're asking like quite meaningful questions about like the human soul and like the meaning of life, and this is a guy that drew Green Arrow, people. Do you know what I mean? So there's quite a few layers to him. But
mythic is out there as well, isn't it? Like that's the title. Yeah. Just the crazy, same
thing, but a little less reverent.
Yeah.
But what is it about that sort of more cerebral side of like storytelling and the darkness that sort of really appeals to you?
It's more engaging to me. I mean, that's I think those are questions that everybody lives with or should live with.
Yeah.
And why not tackle them in sort of every medium? And comics is one of those mediums. And even books that I thought were like, you know, fun or funny books like Mythic, or I did another book even less people read called Golly at Image.
Right.
And they both, you know, like they try to be, or the Wretch is the same way. It's like, I'm trying to have fun, but at the end, it's a meaning of life comic somehow, you know? And I think that's from freaking Jim Starlin, like Adam Warlock polluting my mind when I was a kid.
He's polluted a lot of minds, the old Warlock comic, isn't he? Yeah, I've got to be honest with you.
But Kirby's the same way. Kirby, everything's a big idea, even if it's like, oh, you know, like Commandy's about this, you know, when you're a kid, you see Commandy, you're like, oh, it's even better than Planet of the Apes because all the animals are smart. And I'm the only person, and that's awesome. You know, and also I can drive and shoot a gun, and I'm 15. All those things sound cool to a 15-year-old. But what that comic is really about is, because when you're 15, finding your place in the world is a lot like finding your place in a world of talking animals. Puberty is a lot like being the last kid on Earth.
Yeah, I grew up with a lot of robot gangsters. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, about those. But you know what I mean? Like, there's a surface engagement to all of Kirby's stuff and all of Starlin's stuff. And then there's a deeper engagement. And then I feel like if you're not getting that deeper engagement, you're sort of missing a facet of what makes stuff memorable. And like, I know what the Coffin sold, and I know what Deep Sleeper sold, and it's not a lot. Right. But I know the Wretch sold, and it's even less. But people talk to me about those books all the time. Like, they remember those books from when they were kids. So they were never hit albums, but they were sort of like the records that the bands who went on to have hit albums listened to when they were kids.
Interesting.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'll say, I mean, rarely do I get the chance to say this, but Coffin and Deep Sleeper are two of my favourite books ever. So
yeah, you've been mentioning
I just want to say
thank you
for those, because
no, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, championing them for ages.
Well, I appreciate it. If you ask Mike and I, that's Deep Sleeper's our favourite thing.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay.
It was one of the first books, because I was reading it in the issues when it came out as well. It was one of the, you know, I had like the bigger sort of titles, you know, the Marvel and DC stuff. But then there was this sort of in more of an independent, bit of a different title that just stuck out to me. And when it got to the end, it was one of the first comics that actually got me emotional at the end.
Oh, no, that's what I wanted.
Yeah. So, yeah, funny. So I've learned that Phil Hester wanted to make me cry.
Yeah, you're a cruel man, Phil.
You're a cruel man. That's okay. No, but it's crying in a good way, because it's a really touching,
it's hopefully uplifting in some way. Yeah, like that's the goal. So like, even like I said, even when I'm writing something as like purposefully crude as Golly, it's still got these moments in it that are sort of like, oh, here's some, like, I don't know what the truth is, but here's like our little sign path on the way to truth, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. There has to be nuance, isn't there? There's got to be something, because, like, I mean, it's like comedy.
There always has to be, isn't there? Good art always has to have levels, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Because otherwise, if it's just surface level all the time, it won't be as well remembered as the stuff that has more to it.
No, like, and that's what I think about when I'm, like, when I was a kid, like, what I liked about, to tie a bow on it, what I liked about E-Man was how it was drawn, how it was so lively and bouncy, and how pretty Novocaine was and all that stuff. But why I love it today is because of the naivete, you know, because it was just pure.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why I love it. And so that's the deeper level of engagement.
And so it gives you the ability to rediscover things as well, I think, when it's that, you know.
Yeah. So the things that stick around are the things that find that second level. And you never know when you're doing it until you've done it. And the only way to do it is to get in on a book and sort of like live with it for a while and try to speak to people. Like if you develop a project as an idea, if you get an idea and you develop the project, you have to become passionate about it at some point to like think it's worthwhile to develop. Mm. And then the trick is like making other people as passionate about it. And I don't care if that, I clearly do not care if that's 200,000 people or 2,000 people. That's my career debt, isn't it? As to that. Like, I don't care. As long as the 2,000 people that got it.
Hmm. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. That's a good way to look at it, isn't it? You're not writing for the next big hit. You're writing so that people, you know, connect to it. Yeah, definitely. Hmm.
Yeah, because this is something I was telling a lot of guys at the Independent Comics Expo yesterday, is that like, if you put out a book and you sell 1,000 copies, it's easy to get discouraged. You're like, oh God, why was I killing myself and I only reached 1,000 people?
Yeah.
And like, look at it from the other side. If you had a gallery show and 1,000 people showed up, it would be a smash.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
And also they showed up and paid $4 to get in. You know. So there are 1,000 people out there that gave you their hard earned money, like, because they thought what you had to imagine was worth looking at.
Yeah.
So it's
all I can think of now, Phil, is 1,000 people. We need to do a convention in America, guys.
Yeah, I know.
a little show over here is like 1,000 people. Yeah. Very little.
Right, okay. Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I just did a show in Grand Island, Nebraska, which the population of the whole town is 48,000.
Right. I think
they had 2,000 people come to the convention. So
that's great.
Wow. Yeah.
I'll book that one for us next time then, lads.
Yeah.
that's a couple of long fights.
Yeah. And you have to, there's a sled for the final bit. Is that right?
You're in a grain wagon for the last half of it.
Have you, are there any, I'll put you on the spot slightly, Phil, but are there any English or British comic characters you'd like to draw? Or you fancy?
Oh, I love drawing Judge Dredd.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know how to ever make that happen, or if I can ever make that happen, because I would have to get in line behind all the British and European artists that want to do that.
They go through quite a few. You know, they change up arcs and, I think it's fairly doable.
Actually, yeah. I love them all. Like, when I was in high school, I found a, I don't know how it got over here, but there was just, like, a stack of 2000 ADs at my comic shop, like a knee-high stack. And I bought as many as I can afford. And that was, like, during the Judge Child.
That's a good period. Yeah.
It was a good era, yeah. And there was just all sorts of cool stuff in that. And I was like,
yeah, this Bolland and this... McMahon and everyone in here. Yeah.
Like, this stuff really speaks to me, and I could get down with any of that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I'd love to see you draw the Robusters, if you're aware of them.
Oh, yeah, I'd be into that, too.
Yeah, they're great. Awesome. I think your style would be superb on that, yeah.
That's like the... If the American comics market ever disappeared, I fantasize that I could, like... like, I could probably work in South America, maybe, and you know...
And what are those things you have out there? Is it Tijuana Bibles? Is that what they're called?
You're right.
Yeah. No,
listen, I have friends that did back when Fantagraphics was doing those on a regular basis. the Arrows. Right. I have friends that made up pseudonyms and went to work there.
That's great. Yeah. For those who don't know, Tijuana Bibles are kind of basically saucy, sexy comics, aren't they?
They're porn.
Yeah.
I love that. It's like if
you were really interested in how Popeye and olive oil did it,
they are anatomically quite strange looking, so I'd be interested.
Listen, I'm curious.
And so is probably a good quarter of our listeners. who are frantically Googling as we speak.
Please. We're in the Google time now. Like, I think there's a... I invented this game that's called Google Roulette, which is you do a Google image search of the most innocuous term and see how many results it takes to hit porn. Because like a couple of years ago, I was laying out Teen Titans for DC and I had to draw the jet. So I was like, I'm going to go ahead and Google Titans jet. And guess how many results it took to get to 16. Just 16. 16 until you saw Starfire having sex with an anthropomorphic jet.
Just forward us that link if you get a chance. Yeah.
No, it's out there, believe me. And you know what's even more sobering is when you create something that somehow breaks into the mainstream even a little bit, like Fire Breather. I did a book for Image called Fire Breather, like in the 2000s, and I made it onto Cartoon Network. And once something makes it onto Cartoon Network,
oh god,
it's like, listen, the leash is off on these freaks, and they're just out there making every possible porn combination of your cartoon characters.
If anything, that's a huge sign that you've made it, though, isn't it?
I guess so.
Yeah.
But
listen, I've got a number of copies of Dr. Screw in the TARDIS on DVD. I'm willing to send you.
But it's just like, it's like, oh, I've made it. Great.
You just got to make sure it doesn't end up on your Wikipedia page. That's the...
Yeah. It's when you start ringing the studio and asking to attend the filming.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh.
Yeah.
You start getting a credit on it. You're like, oh, look, credit. IMDb. Here we go.
Oh, God.
Starfire's Jet 3.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. It's out there. Listen, I know you're going to find it. It's out there. You'll
I'll tell you what people should find, though, and that's your work and like when you're going to be at conventions and stuff. Do you have any, in terms of books, what's going to come out later this year that you can talk about at the moment?
Okay. I'm working on an unannounced Robin graphic novel. Maybe I shouldn't say. Anyway, it's an unannounced Robin graphic novel. I'm just helping with the storytelling on. In a way I've sort of been doing for DC on a few books, like when they want Like I did a Dead Man book a couple of years ago and Teen Titans a few years ago, where I just sort of parachute in and help the current artist with storytelling, you know, light thumbnail things for them. Yeah. And then I'm writing Stronghold for Aftershock. I'm writing an unannounced science fiction horror comic for Oni that will be out sometime in the future.
Oh, wow. And
you had me at horror comic.
And then my big project for the year is I'm drawing a new book with Jeff Lemire for Image called The Family Tree, and that will be out this fall.
Oh, brilliant.
Oh, awesome.
Nice.
So you've not got much on then. That's fine.
I guarantee you I forgot something.
Well, you know, if you remember it, just let us know and then we'll give it a shout on the show.
We'll do a part two just to talk about things.
Oh, yes, that'd be amazing. Well,
we'll be ringing you next week now. Here we go.
Well, I mean, I say this with so many of our guests, but there's so much more that we could talk about. But what other conventions have you got later in the year if people... Like from the state.
You're in New York this year, Phil, aren't you?
No, I'm not. Like I said, I'm not in huge ones this year. Mm. Boy, people's best chance to meet me was probably Kansas City last month.
Right.
Unless you're a Midwesterner, and then you won't be able to escape me. I'm at pretty much every kind of local Midwest show. I'll be in Omaha later in the year, and and next weekend I'll be at Free Comic Book Day in Denver at a shop called Hall of Justice.
Okay.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, that's it.
So if you're in that area, definitely check them out. I've seen that you've done some awesome sort of commissions recently. Is that something you do just personally or just for shows?
It's usually what happens is I go to a show to do and take a list of commissions.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also do... like sort of that European tradition of doing remarks in people's books or little quick doodles and sketchbooks. And that winds up taking up my whole day at the booth, at the table. And so I have to go do sketches at night in the hotel room.
What's the rudest thing you've written in someone's book?
Only at people's request. Like if somebody requests something rude, I might, but listen, I turn down more than I accept. Believe me. In terms of requests for sketches. But so I, like I said, I usually wind up taking them home and finishing them. And that's usually what I'm posting are overdue con sketches.
Yeah. But Phil will post them on his Twitter feed. So definitely check them out because there's some awesome stuff on there, including that fantastic ROM sketch you did for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Love is that, ROM, is that fundraiser still open at the moment? If you want to tell us a little bit about that.
Bill Mantlo's brother, for people that don't know, Bill Mantlo, who gave us Rocket Raccoon, and then for people of my age, pretty much was writing every other comic in the 80s.
As well, and all sorts of things. Yeah, Alpha Flight.
Just sort of an ever-present creator when I was a kid. And he, right after he quit comics to practice law, he was fighting a good fight. He was going to go become a public defender. He was hit by a taxi in New York, and he has a catastrophic brain injury. And he was a young man when it happened, so he's been in long-term care for a long time, and he's going to be in long-term care for the rest of his life. And it's essentially bankrupted his brother, who is his caregiver. And so his brother is he's running a GoFundMe. So just Google GoFundMe and Mantlo, Mantlo.
Yeah.
You'll find a fundraiser.
But it's a crying shame, man. I mean, I love America, but your healthcare does need sorting out, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's frustrating and it just boggles my mind.
We're very lucky over here with the NHS. We've got a great
system. Hang on
to it. Yeah, I know, we know. Definitely.
But if there's any listeners out there who want to contribute, you know, definitely check that out and just pledge to it. It's a very worthwhile cause. But and where can people find you online, etc., Phil?
I'm just pretty much I do have a website that I never update. but once the Wretch Omnibus comes out, I'm doing a collection of every single Wretch story that ever came out ever.
Oh my god.
And, one new story that nice. Will come out later in the year. And once that comes out, we'll sort of do everything at the Phil Hester website. But the easiest way to keep up with me is to follow my Twitter feed, which is just at Phil Hester or at Phil Hester. Yes. And I'm right okay. there.
Yes. Cool. Definitely. Nice. So, folks, go follow Phil. If you see him at a show, go up, say hi, and like tell him you love his work.
Yeah. Smell the back of my head.
Smell the back of his head.
Try and look through the back of his head, see if you can see it as a telescope. Yeah.
I mean, we laugh at that, but that might happen in a few months, and you might.
Oh, Lord.
There's a few strange people who follow us. I'll be honest with you, Phil.
Trace back to this appearance.
Yeah. So remember. This might be used as evidence.
We don't endorse any of that.
No. But stay tuned for Phil's comics, and he will be back in the future. That's for certain.
Definitely.
And thank you for joining us this week, Phil. It's been brilliant.
Oh no, anytime, absolutely, guys. Man. Anytime.
Cheers, Phil.
Yeah. Okay. Cheers, man.
Bye. Thanks.
And another one. I was about to say bites the dust, but that was absolutely brilliant totally interview wrong. There.
It was good, wasn't it? Yeah. Really good.
Yeah.
It's nice when your comics heroes turn out to be good guys. Do you know what I mean? I do like that. We've been lucky with that, really.
We have been very lucky because,
Touchwood, there's no one we've had on the show that I've really wanted to speak to and they've been a douchebag. Do you know what I mean? They've always been really, I'm so pleased that's the case.
Yeah. And then this is one of the ones for me that I just thought, I'm such a fan of the man's work. I thought, right, okay, let's.
He's lovely.
Really nice bloke. And I know we said it in the interview, but definitely check out a lot of his work, whether it be, if you're into DC, whether it's the Green Arrow stuff or the independent stuff like the Wretch and Coffin and stuff, because it's
I'd recommend the Godzilla book he did as well.
Incredible. To pick
that up. Oh mate, so good. It's basically that new movie, but they wrote it years ago.
Yeah,
the new movie where he battles all the different monsters. Yeah. It's basically that.
It was one of the things that we didn't talk about in that chat, wasn't it?
Yeah.
On my notes, but we never get around to it. But once again, it's another one to add to the list.
He's had so much out though. He's done so much. There's pages and pages of his stuff on Comixology.
Yeah.
Usually I try and read most of a creator's work before they come on the show, but there's no way you can manage it with him.
No. Even if it's just the writing alone, do you know what I mean? And certainly, back to Comic House, there's a lot of, especially the Dynamite stuff on there.
Yeah, and it's good stuff, really good stuff. The pulpy stuff Dynamite do is some of my favourite stuff that they do,
So it's great. So, another brilliant guest in the bag. The last one before episode 200.
Yes.
What a segue into the shout-outs, eh?
Nicely done.
Well, we've been doing this for 199 flipping weeks. Episode 200 is this coming Saturday.
Now, it is. Come around quick, isn't it?
Yeah, it has indeed. Now, those obviously, if those people are listening live, and I know a lot of our listeners listen fresh every week, May the 4th, 2019 is going to be the date where we will all be in the same room attempting to record a live show. Obviously, when it comes out, it won't be live. It'll be recorded, but so don't debate that with me.
It'll be like kind of like a comics burlesque sort of crossover.
Yeah, what? You're not going to have the tassels on.
You know it.
Oh,
I'm going to have three. Guess where the third one will be?
Oh, no. You can twirl that. No.
You shared a room with me. Again.
It is going to be comic fan friendly, but it's going to be a lot of fun. So what we're doing, we turn up on May the 4th at... Tony?
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the pub suddenly.
It's the Two Chairmen pub. Live in London. And you've been talking to these people.
I know. I'm going there tomorrow to check the venue out again. I couldn't remember it. You did that to me last week as well, and I felt bad.
But yes, it is. Is it the oldest pub in London?
It is, yeah. That's what it says on its Wikipedia page.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, it's at 39 Dartmouth Street, Westminster, London. It's very, very close to Parliament Square. So if you can find Big Ben, I'm sure most of you can manage that, you'll find this pub. And we're in the upstairs bar. If you're going to buy a drink or buy something to eat, please buy upstairs because it balances out against the money we paid for the room.
Yeah, so if you're going to be joining us for the live recording, come straight upstairs. We've got the room between 12 and 5.
Yep.
And basically, there's just going to be lots of just comic chat and just a general just good fun. And we're just going to have a natter. And then we're going to record the show probably between 2 and 4.
Yeah, that's the plan.
Yeah, that's the plan.
Won't happen, but that's the plan.
Yeah. We've already had... thank you to everyone who's told us that they're going to try and make it on the day. No matter how far you travel. We're going to do something a little bit different as well. We're going to try and get... You know, before we actually record the show, we're going to probably speak to a few of you as well.
Yeah, we'll do a bit of roving reporting.
Yeah,
a bit of roving reporting
in a room. And then you can order your cheesy chips and listen to us talk a load of bollocks for a couple of hours. Yeah.
With some craft ales or whatever they sell in pubs these days. I don't know.
Are you an ale fan, Tony?
I'm not big time. You know, I'll probably have a drink. I might just have a pint of lager during the recording. I think I'd do a bit of that.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I've been pissed whilst recording, so I think we could have a go at it, couldn't we?
Yeah. Well, no, I'm not going to.
Why?
Well, because I'm recording it.
Oh, because you're going to edit it on the way home on the bus.
Yep. It's gonna be quite an epic feat, but you know we do it because we love it, and on the day we just want to hang out with you people. So if you can make it, we've got some free badges, and so make it to that event if you can make it. Brilliant, and we're just gonna have a right laugh. But as well, there is a sort of the mighty Richard Sheaf has organised a charity raffle, which all proceeds are going to Little Heroes. As you well know, we love that charity.
Yeah.
And there's so many. We've had so many donations to this. Thank you to everyone who's donated original art, books, all kinds of stuff. We've got so many prizes, literally so many prizes. So if you buy tickets, there's a good chance you're going to win.
A very good chance at this stage that you're going to win something.
Yeah.
And it might well be a page of original art, which is going to be incredible.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because
there's a few DC and Marvel creators turning up as well, dare I say it.
Yeah.
Titan creators. Yeah, there's a few, there's going to be a few people in the audience who are comic professionals as well. So it's going to be an interesting crowd, I think.
Yeah. And it's going to be a bloody good laugh. But what's the link to get their tickets, Tony, for the raffle?
Yeah, if you go to boysadventurecomics.blogspot.com, there's, you can either donate, just straight donate money or to Little Heroes, or you can buy a raffle ticket for the Little Heroes raffle. And we'll be probably at some point, it probably won't be during the live recording, but at some point in the day, we'll be drawing some raffle tickets out and seeing who's won. And we'll find some way to let you know as soon as we can that you've won, whether it be a live stream or whatever we're going to do. Something like that, we'll just post it on the Facebook page.
And literally, you know, I mean, the only thing you have to pay is your raffle ticket and the postage to get your goodies delivered to you. And there's so many amazing goodies.
And if you're local, I'll just meet up with you and hand them over. There's no dramas around that.
But it's all for a brilliant cause. So if you want to help Little Heroes get more comic making kits to the kids in hospitals, then that's the way to do it.
Cool.
So I sounded like Punch from Punch and Judy then, didn't I?
Yeah, a little bit. It's nice. Yeah.
Well, you know. Well, I am wearing the pyjamas. What? Yes. So there you go. And we can't wait to see you this.
Yes.
Yeah, this weekend. Although, if you're catching up, because I know a lot of our listeners like to save a couple of weeks
for a long drive or something.
If you were there, wasn't it a lovely time?
What a great
time!
If
you weren't there, sorry.
Yeah, I'm genuinely looking forward to it. It's a cracking little pub from what I can see. A little sort of private room upstairs. There's a bit of history to it and stuff. And you'll be able to pick up your free comic book day just around the corner.
Yeah,
in Soho or in Leicester Square, and come down to us. It's not far; it's a short walk.
It's going to be good. Yes. So there you go. So have we got any other Tony? You must have shout outs.
Yeah, I've got a few.
Go for it.
If you're going to Lawless, which Vince will be repping the pod.
I will indeed.
Yeah. So that and go and buy something off his table. We'll be also Iz McAuliffe, our pal, is doing a panel called "Growing Up with British Comics." And on it will be Boo Cook, Simon Davis, love Simon's work, absolutely brilliant, Sally Jane Hurst, and Abigail Bulmer. And it's going to, and anyone who's been to any of his panels, they know they're great. She's very, very knowledgeable about 2000 AD as well. So Growing Up with British Comics, which I think is a really good idea for a panel, because it's going to be loads of what influenced them growing up and recommends. And you can always get an artist talking about what comics they love as opposed to what comics they create sometimes, I think. Yeah, so good little one. Thanks to Stuart McCune. Not only did I get my reality paper Kickstarter, which is outstanding, which is probably the near, it's a mixture of comics and art and text pieces and prose and stuff, and it is just an absolutely beautiful oversized book. He also sent me a load of Italian comics through. Me and him, we swapped back issues through the post, and he sent and it included some great Dylan Dog stuff. So thanks, Stuart. I know it's a little bit advanced, but if you're going to MCM, which I know the pod are at as well, Vince, yep. You're doing it, aren't you? Vince and Dan.
Yeah, you know it. Yeah, we're going to be there.
I'll be doing the No Brow table. And if you want any pre-orders, then let us know, because we're not going to be able to bring the whole No Brow stock to the MCM. So if there's anything in particular that you want out of the back catalogue at No Brow or Fly and I, then let me know on the social medias and I'll bring it along. And the other one is we've just seen, I've just messaged her, but get well soon, Sarah Harris. I know she's not been that well, yes. And I think she's having a bit of a bad day.
Yeah, and, get well soon, Sarah.
Yeah, I hope she feels better soon.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, she knows she's one of the family. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and plus, if you heard that bell, that means it's the weekly mention of her.
Yes, yeah, ding.
We should have a bell. Someone should ring a bell every time that happens.
Yeah, time an angel gets its wings. What's
yeah, exactly. But, you know, we wouldn't mention her if she wasn't bloody awesome. And yeah, I know a lot of our listeners are now have become friends with her and realise how bloody awesome she is. So, yeah, so get well soon, Sarah.
Yeah, definitely.
And, yeah, have you got any shout-outs, Dan?
I don't know what you shouted out about.
We've done it.
Yeah. Dan was too busy putting his trousers back on to listen to what we were shouting about. But
I joined the ranks of the elites. I had Vanguard pirated.
Which was, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm a big boy now.
Yeah. So basically what we've learned this week is porn parodies and being pirated are signs that you've made it.
I've got to work on that porn parody now.
Yeah. I'm filming it now.
Live action.
What would it be called? No, do you know what? I thought of some names for it, but I'm not going to say it. Yeah. I'll tell you off air, Dan.
Don't say Bum Guard. Okay. What?
No, that wasn't the one I was going to go for.
If you've got a porn parody name for Vanguard, why not write in? Title, subject line, Vanguard porn parody.
Oh my god. You know that you're going to be in that's a dangerous bottle to open, Dan. You know that. But anyway, yes, after another successful chat about comics, before it goes completely off the rails, I suppose we should recommend some comics to people, shouldn't we? Who wants to go first this week? Dan, I know you said you might want to get something off your chest.
Yeah, I kind of I mentioned this. I got this one for Christmas and started reading it, but something came up, so I went back to it. And it's Batman White Knight by Sean Murphy, which to get it out of the way, the art and is absolutely fantastic. I absolutely love it. I love his style. He just does. I just love the style. I'd love to kind of be work like this. It's so good. But it's got like DC Black label, and I don't really know too much about it. But essentially, this it's like another sort of tries to get a definitive take on Batman. And like halfway through reading it, I was like, I don't really want to read any more Batman stories like this ever again. Really? Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, but it's kind of every time I pick up a Batman trade nowadays, they always try and reinvent the wheel. And do something like groundbreaking. So this is the new norm, and it's like I've just seen it so many times. I just don't. Perhaps I need to take a bit of a break from Batman. But
maybe. But also sometimes there's a lot to be said for when you've established your character as a certain sort of thing. It's like just give us an absolutely awesome detective story with Batman.
Yeah. Rather than trying to reinvent the world and say, like this is how. Yeah. I'm not sure. I think it's kind of like an Elseworlds tale.
Yeah, it kind of is, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
It's are there many sort of Batman tales that are straight-up detective? Without take away the gadgets and the computers and everything, what are some of the more recent ones where you really see examples of someone who's supposed to be the world's greatest detective?
I'm not the biggest Batman reader, so I couldn't tell you.
No, I
have to say I'm slightly frustrated with Batman at the moment. As much as I kind of like Tom King's writing, it's so decompressed. It's so painfully slow every month. It's
really?
Just like whole issues are just seem to happen in one scene, and each issue has kind of got a little bit of an experimentation feel to it. And I don't know. I kind of like. I think comics to survive are going to have to start going back into the one and dones. No one wants to get tied up in these long 4-year arcs. You know, I'm not. Yeah. It's not interesting anymore to anyone.
And one thing when we went back to look at the Kirby Fantastic Four, and you look at the pacing of it, it's like Jesus Christ. Like what he does on some pages, it takes other comic books like half, almost a whole issue to get through.
Yeah,
it's just moving at such a pace.
People are worried about using up all their ideas. They're just ideas. You'll have another one.
Yeah,
you know, the one idea seems to like that White Knight. I've only read one issue of it, but it seems, from what I understand, it's a kind of an idea that could have been extrapolated on, you know, or could have been, you know. But everyone seems to have this one idea for their run, and then they disappear off and do another story. You know, no, just keep writing stories. Yeah,
the idea for the series is that Joker takes like a load of drugs after the Batman's chasing him, and he essentially becomes cured and turns back into sort of Jack Napier, and then he starts like a legal battle, a battle against GCPD for like enabling Batman over the years, and Batman becomes the enemy over Jack Napier. But that's sort of, there's a lot more to it, but that's kind of the crux of the story.
Yeah.
Also, did you forget that this guy's like the one of the biggest murderers on the planet ever?
Right. yeah, I mean, to me, it almost felt a bit like a vehicle for the art to be.
Yeah,
everyone did go nuts about it, and I think the art is absolutely gorgeous. And again, it's back in the Sienkiewicz sort of Butcher Baker wheelhouse a little bit, isn't it? Sort of,
yeah,
like very sort of scratchy but super detailed, and you know, your eye gets used to it, and it is beautiful. But I don't know. Yeah,
yeah, I kind of halfway through it, I was like, oh god, I'm not really liking this, but I kind of got through to the end because I wanted to see how it played out. And kind of there's a couple of times during the story where like he mentions SJWs like unironically, and I'm like, oh god, it's do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I just want Gene Colan back.
Yeah.
And bring back Marshall Rogers, that's all I need. Yeah.
What Evan Dawkins said to me last week, or the other week, it really kind of had a bit of an impact on me. It kind of got in there, like when he was saying about like Batman just being Batman and doing this and that, and it doesn't have to be these big sort of deconstructions and uber dark stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, he's right. You know what I mean? I just...
Yeah. There's like Batman recently, there's this long, long wind up to him getting married to Catwoman. It's just been going on for fucking seemingly years.
Yeah.
And so they had the classic, oh, why don't we have them on their hen night stroke stag night? And it's just like, this is just so predictable.
Can't they take a look back in time and see when this happened to Spider-Man and how it absolutely fucking detonated the character?
Yeah.
Like, it just killed the character dead.
Stays in with Clark Kent and they play chess. And I'm thinking, if I was Batman, the way I enjoy myself as Batman is punching the faces of villains in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Surely be too guilty to do it.
Yeah. Exactly. Like,
oh, there's a fucking load of people out there going mad. I better stay and get pissed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Superman say to him, look, tonight in Gotham, I got it. It's not a problem. And he can go off and go mad in Vegas or whatever.
Yeah,
Batman goes mad in Vegas.
Oh, yeah. Let's write that. Anyway, yeah, I need to. One of my work colleagues gave me White Knight to read actually, and I flipped through it, and like you say, it looks beautiful, but I haven't had a chance to read it yet. So, interesting.
Here we go. After I've done that sterling job.
Yeah.
Shall I go next?
Yeah, I want to hear your one because I haven't read this yet.
My one is from Valiant. It's one that I just I took a punt on a couple of months ago. Actually, I'm about to read issue 3 of it. I read issue 1 and 2 as well. It's a 4-issue series of a character that I know nothing about, who I believe is a villain in the Valiant universe. The series is The Forgotten Queen, number one. Here's the synopsis. Long ago, the mighty generals of the Mongol Empire rode from Siberia to Carpathia and conquered all who stood in their way. Legends tell of a witch who walked with them, who could infect the hearts of any warriors in her midst with an unquenchable thirst for battle and bloodshed. A warmonger. And now she is walking again. This is written by Teenie Howard. I hope I said that right. Art by Amil Sar Pina. Colors Ulysses Ariola, letters and logo design, Jeff Powell. And of course, you've got the great sort of Valiant sort of published, you know, editing team behind them. This one was like, you know, just completely out of the dark. I was intrigued by the cover actually, because you see like the main character sort of standing on a sort of sea of sort of dead Mongol sort of warriors. And this came completely out of the blue and is absolutely fucking awesome.
Oh, is it good, is it?
Yeah. It is really good, actually. Starts off, it feels really like a European book as well.
Okay.
Like the sort of thing that we would have probably picked up from Europe comics and been really surprised by. Certainly at the beginning, it starts with like a couple of divers. There's an expedition to the bottom of the sea, a science expedition where they're trying to dig up some ancient artifacts. And one of them happens to be like the bits of armor from an ancient warrior who happens to be the warmonger. I don't know anything about this character. Is this a character that's bigger in the universe yet, Tony?
I mean, she's appeared, but it's not. She's not like a big character or anything. No, not at all.
I mean, for me, this series is the sign of, you know, they could definitely do something more with this character. I'm immediately interested in what this character is.
Right.
Because you have the science expedition trying to find out more about it. Something goes wrong while one of them is searching for the armor, and one of the divers comes a cropper, shall we say, when the warmonger is literally down there and wakes up. But flashback to the story of when she started. She's basically roaming about, and everyone keeps calling her a witch, which she doesn't really consider herself to be that. Some wonderful dialogue in it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to spoil any of this dialogue or read it all out, because I was just reading it thinking, God, this is this dynamic dialogue that I really like. I mean, I haven't read anything by Howard before.
She did some stuff with Black Crown. She did a Captain America, which I wasn't overly in love with.
Yeah.
She's done a few things now,
Yeah, but this one is like got a real good grasp of like the historical sort of... I want to say Conan-esque, but it's not really, you know, it's more historical. But, you know what I mean? The way the warriors talked in that day is this, basically an immortal badass is just walking through. And her power, she literally turns, everyone just looks at her, and because she's a woman, they think, oh, you know, they don't think much of her. She's obviously a witch. And then, without even thinking, she can turn an entire army against itself, and they end up just murdering each other. And she doesn't get touched. She's also a badass warrior, which you see as well. Brilliant series. The art is spectacular once again. This is Europe comics sort of stuff, and I like the fact that it's four issues as well. It's nice sort of contained. I mean, it feels by the end of issue two I thought, oh my god, this can't be a long series, because it feels like it's approaching, it is telling two stories. This, you know, the scientist trying to find out more about this suit of armor, and at the same time the flashback to the woman through the ages and her story and build it. It's an origin story for a villain, which I didn't really know. I didn't know anything about this. And then at one point it sort of says that she is like a massive villain. I thought that's quite interesting. I didn't, you know, I'm on her side yet not on her side.
But I was talking to someone about this earlier. That's what the Valiant universe does. There's no like really good guys and really bad guys, really. I mean, if you look at Exo, he can be pretty vicious and pretty brutal and pretty murdering, you know. And Archer and Armstrong and all these sort of people, you know. There's a lot of levels and, you know, levels of grey in what they're doing, some of these characters. You know, they do that well, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And there's also some sort of wonderful moments of... It's reflective, like the villain who knows they're a villain, but... Everyone thinks that she's evil, where she just feels hollow inside. It's hard to describe it, but definitely if you're interested, and I didn't feel like I had to be attached to the Valiant universe. I've read some stuff, but you know, I didn't want to get into a series where all of a sudden I was lost. Unity are in it, in history, and I know they're Eternal Warrior and stuff like that.
Okay. Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, she bumps into them at one point.
Yeah, because they're now disbanded, so yeah, that's got to be...
Yeah, that was at the time where she has this relationship with this sort of warrior queen, and they spend some time apart, and when she comes back, Unity are almost like they're counselling her about something. And that was when I looked at it and thought, that's Eternal Warrior.
Yeah. And Livewire, and yeah.
Yeah, and the queen immediately sort of looks at them and just thinks, well, they're pieces of shit.
Right.
Yeah, so I don't know whether that'll build to anything, but definitely check it out. The issues are sort of like $1.99. I think they're $2.49 on Comixology when they come out, but then you wait, I don't know, a month.
I think
or
you
two.
Have to wait a month and a half, isn't it?
Yeah,
I think something like that. Yeah.
Down. So you can get issue 1 and 2 for $1.99. Issue 3's just come out, and even if you're just buying the actual paper copies, this is a series that you don't. The Forgotten Queen should not be a series that's forgotten. I know that sounds cheesy, but I can see how some people, this might go over their heads because it's not. It doesn't have your XOs or, you know, your some of the spectacular covers like for Eternal Warrior and things like that.
But they're pretty reliable at having sales in Comixology as well, Valiant. Yeah. They do have regular ones.
Yeah. And I know, obviously, when Heather Antos was talking, this was just about to come out when she was on, wasn't it, I think?
That's right. We mentioned it just as we say goodbye to her, actually, I think.
Definitely check it out, people. It's a good time to do it. There's 3 issues out. One more left. So, yeah, highly recommended from me. So, what's yours, Tony?
Mine's a bit of a deep dive, I'm afraid. So, are you a fan of Philip K. Dick? Are you a fan of his stuff?
Are you asking me if I like Dick?
Yes.
I can't say I'm that au fait with his writings. Dan, are you?
Dan's disappeared off, hasn't he?
Oh, has he?
His computer's crashed, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
He loves us and leaves us, doesn't he?
He does.
We love you, Dan. But anyway, no, I can't say I'm au fait with Philip K. Dick, but...
I'm a fan. I was like a huge fan. I read sort of 20 of his books or something, you know, and every so often I'll go back and read something by him. And I think, to be honest with you, and I'll probably get to this towards the end, this is one of the appeals for the book for me. So this is Philip K. Dick, a comics biography. And it's I think in French it was called something else. It was called Phil, Une Vie de Philip K. Dick. So I like the fact that it's just called Phil. I kind of like that.
Yeah.
Its writer is Laurent Quasi. Artist is Mauro Marchesi. It's lettered by Ortho in English. It was released in February this year and translated by Edward Govan. It's 144 pages, full colour, hardback, published by NBM Publishing. Have you come across them at all?
NBM is a publisher that one of my favourite books, Boneyard.
Okay.
That's the only time I ever really heard of NBM, because their logo's got a real, it's almost, I would say, a 70s kind of vibe to it.
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
They're doing a lot of translations and stuff like that. I follow them on Instagram. They put some interesting art up and stuff.
Oh, nice.
£20.99. It's basically a very well-told story of his life. So it cleverly opens in 1981 with Dick visiting the Ridley Scott and seeing an early cut of Blade Runner. And I was glad to see that he was very much in love with the film. You know, he really did like it. He came up with a few faults, but he really did like it, you know, and I was sort of chuffed because that was kind of the door opening for me for his books, is I saw Blade Runner, and then I think the second or third book I read was To Android's Dream of Electric Sheep, and I read sort of Clans of the Alphane Moon and all this sort of stuff. And you get a couple of pages, he then collapses a year later, and the book then heads back to tell... In a way, a sort of chronologically told story of his life. And as a boy, he was really into science fiction, the science fiction pulps, anthology books, and Quarterly's like Astounding Science Fiction, and authors like A. Van Vogt, if you've ever read any of his stuff. And he has an attack again as a kid. And this is where I fell in love with the book. This is where I thought, right, this is not just a straight telling. It's an interpretation. So as a kid, he has an attack and he collapses and goes unconscious, and he then shrinks down and ends up climbing onto the chest of the comatose version of him as an adult in 1982. And I think this is great. This, and they tell the biographical or certain aspects of the biographical elements of his life as if they were themes in his novel, because obviously his novels carried a lot of personality and are we really who we think we are? And, you know, this sort of thing. So even as a teenager, Dick was a strange guy, and he was questioning everything, and he would talk to his friends and say, well, you see, it's a red traffic light, is it really red? And he was very much a sort of questioner of the reality of things. He tells his mother Dorothy, he calls his mother Dorothy. I'm always amused by people who don't call their mothers mum or something, you know what I mean? It was always that odd friend at school, isn't it, who called his mother Velma or something, you know what I mean? It's one of those sort of things. And he tells her he's moving out, and she says, what are you doing? Don't move out. You might end up a homosexual. So I think she was a kind of strange influence on his life.
Yeah.
And you begin to see from that point onwards how he views reality and his future and his past and the alternatives to reality. And he goes to, there's a really lovely moment, which I really liked, where he goes to a science fiction convention and he bumps into a young Harlan Ellison, who was his pal. And at that, he meets Paul Anderson, and he actually meets A.E. Van Vogt. And then later on, so he follows him through his life. He was a bit of a shagger, Dick. I think he had five wives in the end. You got to love him, didn't you? I don't think any of them ended particularly well, but he did have five wives. He's with one wife, and some FBI agents come to the house and interview his wife about some rallies. You know, it's very much like, are you a communist kind of period in the sort of 60s and stuff, wasn't there? You know, people who went on rallies, you know, anti-Vietnam rallies and stuff like that, were interviewed by the FBI. But obviously, Dick, because he's this sort of super paranoid guy, decides it's about him, and it's because he's written these stories and he actually knows what's going on. And then just in a strange sort of twist of fate, turns out one of these FBI agents becomes his pal and teaches him how to drive. It's just full of these sort of weird little anecdotes about him. At that point, he began to really start hitting the amphetamines, and he would get them wherever he could. He was buying them from dealers. He was stealing from his mother, because you can be prescribed amphetamines, can't you?
Yeah.
And he started seeing these sort of regular hallucinations, which are not overly played in the comic. Then there are moments, and you see the hallucinations, you see what he sees, but it's not done as a sort of trippy comic at all. I'm going to say that if you're a fan of Philip K. Dick and classic sort of 50s, 60s and 70s sci-fis, this is going to be a book for you. If you're not, then I'm going to say you'll probably find it a little dry. I'll be honest with you. I'm a huge fan of Paul Anderson and, you know, Harlan Ellison, all these sort of guys as well. I grew up reading all those sort of very strange pre-Star Wars science fiction books. And what it does, it really drills into Philip K. Dick's personality. He went through some really, really bad mental illnesses. As he went through a number of wives, it's sort of his life is sort of dual personalities and five wives. So he does get there, most of whom are younger than him. He suffers from paranoia of surveillance. His books deal with the senses of identity and the paranoia of surveillance. So, you know, if you read something like Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said, or something like that, you know, A Scanner Darkly, you know, there's all this stuff about, am I really who I really am? Am I spying on myself? Are the state spying on me? Am I being drugged? You know, these huge sort of conspiracy things, big business, government snooping, reality shifting. And what they ultimately do is they show that he had this sort of huge imagination, which was equally compounded by his like real depression problems. The dialogue's great, actually. Edward Govan, who's done the translation, does really well. I have to say, sometimes I find these a little staccato, but he's a lot of these scenes are like snatch moments. So you get like moments of melodrama and you get moments of depression and, you know, drama and stuff like that. And the translations are done really well, really, really well. The art's got, you know, like the European clean line style, you know,
yeah.
It's got that, but I would mix it with someone like Klaus.
I can see a couple of pages on Comixology and there's definitely a real clean look to it. Yeah.
Yeah, and they use that sort of Klaus flat colour almost, you know, like that.
Yeah.
There's a real sort of shine to anything. And that, I think, exemplifies the period that a lot of it's coming from. It's done really well. The end of it, you see like it takes you really to the right to the end of his life. But what it does is it also adds little chapter breaks. So you get little chapter breaks that are just a single image on a page, you know, like a big white page. And in the middle of it will be an image, which is like a break in a chapter. And occasionally they bear examination. One of them, I just thought, oh, that's a chapter break. He's in a bed. And I had another look at it. And if you look more closely, half of his body has been sort of cyborgized, as if he's a character in one of his stories. And even if you look at the back cover, it's a lovely printed on hardback, and the back cover is a little summary of the book. There's a spray can at the top that says Ubik, which is obviously also the name of one of his books, and the bookcase is just a series of his books. But just peeking out between a couple of the books is Philip K. Dick himself, looking out from his own bookshelf, which just speaks loads, sort of thing, you know. As the book continues on, as the book continues to the end, you notice the breakdown in Philip K. Dick, and that also sort of coincided with some of his best stuff, his most paranoid sort of strange experimental stuff. I mean, he wrote a lot of non-sci-fi, a lot of which never got published, and you can find a few books out there of that now. But the sci-fi stuff at the end there is just wacky out there stuff, you know. Yeah. I think it's one of those, I don't know if it's one of those sort of things that teenagers read still, you know. It was used to be when I was a kid, you'd listen to Frank Zappa and you'd read Philip K. Dick. It was one of those sort of passing phases. But I think you can definitely go back. He is one of those science fiction author who's kind of survived with some coolness. You know, if you look at someone like Asimov or Arthur C. Clarke or even Heinlein or someone like that, they're a little bit, you know, old school now, aren't they? We consider them sort of slightly old school, but Philip K. Dick is still in the zeitgeist. I think people are still looking to his books to make movies still. They're still, and the High Castle series is going on Prime, isn't it, at the moment?
But
I really admire it. I went out and bought Exogenesis, which is this 1,000-page book about of all of his translations of all his scribblings and notebooks and stuff, just to try and get, you know, dig a bit deeper. It did inspire me to read. I've just again started the Ganymede Takeover, which I haven't read since I was 14, just because it just piqued my interest in a character that I do find. There's nothing in the man to admire, it's to be fair, apart from his imagination, his ability to write. There's nothing otherwise. He's something of a wife beater. He's something of a drug addict, you know, something of a screaming, melodramatic, paranoid guy. But he's a talented guy, and it's an interesting book, and it's a very pretty book to read. I wouldn't say it's for everyone. Some people will read it and think, oh, it's a bit boring, it's about a weird guy who died in the end, you know. But I really enjoyed it, and I have to say, I put the cover up on Twitter, and a lot of people responded very sort of nicely to the, well, what's that, you know, what's that book? And it's an interesting one.
That's the beauty of the show. People discover books that they had no idea existed.
There you go.
Or they haven't got around to reading yet. So
So many. Not enough time, man.
Yeah, we hope you enjoyed this week's show, as always. And once again, we can't wait to see you at episode 200, or to see what you think of episode 200 when it becomes available. Yeah. And thank you again to the mighty Phil Hester for joining us this week. And to Dan Butcher, who's having some horrible technical problems, which means he's not with us now.
Yeah, my phone keeps lighting. As I was talking there, my phone kept lighting up because it's him going, fuck's sake.
Technology took him away from us, but he can't escape next week because we'll all be in the same room. If there's anything about this week that you want to get us in touch with us about, or perhaps you just want to say how much you agree with our recommendations this week or disagree, then there's several different ways you can get in touch with us. You can email awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. That is also, we've had a few questions for episode 200. What I've said is send some questions and I'm going to ask them live on the show, and the rest of the guys will not know what the answers, you know, what the questions will be. We've had a couple of funny ones, and we've had some absolutely great sort of comics topics as well. It'll probably be most of the show, to be fair, Tony, because, like, you know, I think some of these could really start some good comics discussion. So thank you for them. But if you have a question that you want to ask us, send it to awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter @theawesomepod, where we will be tweeting out the link for this show, we'll be tweeting out the raffle, and then after 200 we'll be tweeting out all the guests we're going to get on and all the topics and stuff, and we probably need to do a poll again at some point.
Yep, we love a poll.
Yep,
just to cheer Tom Curry up.
And if you do Facebook, go to facebook.com/awesomecomicspodcast and follow us on there. And if you do Facebook for group chats or whatever, and you actually want to talk about comics rather than, you know, Kickstarter campaigns or movie talk or any of this nonsense, then join the group Awesome Comics Talk. There's great chatter going on there all the time. I've stayed away from it this week because I went on an internet blackout for pretty much this week. But now I'm back and looking forward to seeing what comic book chat goes on there, because it's fantastic. So thank you for listening to us this week, whether it was on the website awesomecomics.podbean.com. If you listened on iTunes, leave a review, subscribe, helps get the word out about the show. And and you can also hear us on Spotify, which is nice. Makes us feel really legit. As well as other networks like Stitcher, Podnose, Podknife. What other networks are we on, Tony?
We're on Pod Major Dennis Hornbeck.
Make of that what you will.
and if you ask me at the 200th, I'll tell you what that's about.
Lovely. And that's what, if that was a network, that's a hell of a fucking wordy name for a network. But if you heard us on there, then thank you very much, because we truly appreciate every single one of our listeners. Where can people find us online, etc., Tony?
Never on anything.blogspot.co.uk or ezohyz on Twitter.
Lovely. You can find Dan at Vanguard Comic, and his comic is at vanguardcomic.com, which, while he's here, might as well say it. It's bloody brilliant at the moment. It's like The Running Man.
Yeah.
And it's awesome.
He's really experimenting with some art as well, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool stuff.
Yeah. So, yeah, follow him on there. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Jester Diablo, and you can find out more about my comic at redmaskfrommars.com. Thank you, everyone, for listening for the past 199 weeks. We'll probably do a fair bit of like thanking and gushing on episode 200, so I'm not going to do it too much this week.
Okay.
Just thank you for listening, everyone. It's been amazing. And from Dan, Tony, and myself, go forth, read loads of cool comics, and as always, what do they do, Tony?
Oh,
yeah, hey, awesome. Look. Dan's not here, so you've got to say it. What do they do, Tony?
Stay awesome.
Yes. I've beaten him into submission. In all seriousness, have a brilliant week, folks. See ya.
Love you.